the Republicans to wake up is... The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
This program is distributed free, but people voluntarily subscribe. My thanks to Teresa Paris, Susan Fellows, Patricia Player, and Janet Price, a quartet of great American women. Thank you for your support of the Peter B. Collins Show. If you'd like to join them, go to my website at peterbcollins.com. The links for our voluntary subscriptions are on the right-hand side of the homepage, starting at just $5 a month. Here's another installment in the Boiling Frogs interview series, and this is one the CIA doesn't want you to hear. Two researchers who collaborated on a film a few years back called 9/11 Press for Truth scored an exclusive interview with former counterterrorism czar Richard Clark. And in it, as you're about to hear, he names the name of a previously secret director of the CIA Alec station, charged with following Al-Qaeda. And we learn from Sibel Edmonds about, well, some questionable issues from Richard Clark, who was asked to testify before Congress but refused unless he would be paid. This is a stunning episode, and we release this within, well, just 12 hours of the official recognition of 10 years since the 9/11 attacks in New York, Washington, and the plane crash in Pennsylvania. We're still fighting for the truth, and I hope you'll continue that quest with us. Welcome to Boiling Frogs.
Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes. Everybody knows.
Everybody knows. What do they? NSA's illegal domestic wiretapping, FBI's national security letters, state secrets privilege, TSA's 1 million-plus no-fly list, persecution of government whistleblowers, perpetual wars, rendition and torture. Can you feel the water boiling?
Welcome to the Boiling Frogs. With Sibel Edmonds, I'm Peter B. Collins, and we continue our special coverage of the events of September 11th, 2001, as we approach and pass the 10th anniversary of that critical day. We're joined today by filmmakers, documentarians, investigators, John Duffy and Ray Novoshilsky. They met together at film school in Chicago and worked on an important documentary released a few years ago called 9/11 Press for Truth. Gentlemen, welcome to our program today.
Good to be on.
Well, thank you for joining us, and I in particular appreciated the work of Press for Truth. It was a film that helped us understand the issues from the perspective of the Jersey widows, the so-called Jersey girls, one of whom joined us for a recent podcast here on Boiling Frogs, Lori Van Auken. And so you gentlemen have been on this case for many years now. Ray, starting with you, what do you consider to be the status of the investigations into 9/11 and the efforts to overcome the whitewash that created the or enhanced, I suppose, the official narrative of the events, which, of course, doesn't square with real-time accounts, with the laws of physics, and there are many other contradictions that are quite readily apparent.
Well, it's funny you mention that. We just re-interviewed the chairman of the 9/11 Commission today by phone, Tom Kane, and he directed us over to the executive director, Philip Zelikow, who we are exchanging emails with at the present time. You know, the story that we're looking at here, this sort of who is Rich Blee story that is coming out on our website on September 11th of this year, it includes all kinds of stuff that just wasn't included in the 9/11 Commission final report. Or if it was, it was included as a footnote. And in fact, we began our look into this with this one particular footnote called footnote 44, chapter 6 of the 9/11 Commission report. And that was sort of discovered by the Jersey Widows, the women were in Press for Truth, the movie you mentioned. And on the day that the commission report came out, the commissioners called them into this little room to give them an early release of that report. And so those books got handed down the aisles, and these four widows at the center of our story flip open the book, and as if by fate, this one widow, Kristen Breitweiser, who had been sort of following the story of two particular hijackers named Midhar and Hazmi and how many times they'd come on the government's trail, she sort of happens to open to this footnote 44. And what the footnote says is it had been known for some time that the CIA knew about Midhar, this future 9/11 hijacker, having a U.S. visa. But what wasn't known until that footnote was that, in fact, the FBI had tried, an FBI agent had tried to draft a cable to warn their bureau about these guys coming to the U.S., and that cable was squashed by a superior at CIA headquarters.
And, John, in your conversation with Governor Kane, the former co-chair of the 9/11 Commission, did he comment on anything, or did he just deflect all of it to Phil Zelikow? And people should know, Zelikow came out of the White House. He was he had co-authored a book with Condoleezza Rice, and most of us regard him as the gatekeeper who was there to make sure that all the crayons stayed inside the lines.
It was actually the second time that for this project we'd spoken with Kane, and he's actually been quite helpful. I don't want to say negative things about him. He seems to be a nice guy. He seems to care. He claims to be interested in what we're doing. I think this interview today was a little rough because his memory's getting foggy, that sort of thing. You know, he's not really hit to a lot of the details, and we really kind of laid out a lot of things that were, you know, particular to this story that are kind of absent from the final report, and we're kind of hoping to get some sort of comment about, you know, the necessity to look at these things or whatever. And he seems interested, but he doesn't remember a lot of details. He didn't really want to go into a lot of stuff, but first time we interviewed him was a little more, you know, it was years ago, so it was a little, you know, he was a little more fresh. I wouldn't say anything bad about him. He doesn't seem to be covering for stuff, but what I will say is that what we find time and time and time again, no matter who we talk to, like, a lot of these people who were involved, whether in the investigation after the fact or who were players involved in the run-up, they don't get how these pieces fit together after the fact. No matter how much we try to, like, just today we get this email from Philip Zelikow, and we're hitting him with all this stuff we got from Clark. He'd seen some of the media stuff about Clark, and he doesn't get Clark's statement. He's like, well, doesn't Clark realize that it was like a CIA officer, you know, who had, and, you know, who instructed a review of the Malaysia material, and who eventually warned the FBI in August of 2001. What Philip Zelikow doesn't realize is the man he is talking about, Tom Wilshire, who is the deputy director of Alex Station, which is the Bin Laden at CIA,
right?
The Bin Laden unit. Tom Wilshire is the very man who blocked Doug Miller draft cable to the FBI, trying to warn them. The document, it was a draft report, CIR, I know you don't like acronyms, but it's basically like a draft email that this particular FBI agent who is working at the Bin Laden unit at CIA, because they detail these guys to help share information, they, you know, cross bureaus, and he's trying to warn his own bureau with this, you know, email, essentially, and then, you know, someone kind of shuts him down, and he gets this message that reads, please hold off as per deputy director, referencing Tom Wilshire. So Tom Wilshire is basically saying, ah, let's not send this out, and then, you know, and then, but here's Zelikow is trying to say later, like, well, he's the one who tried to share the information in August of 2001. And the whole story is so circular and absurd, and I don't want to bury you in details because I'm sure you got a lot of questions to get through here. But what's fascinating about this very particular topic is that Tom Wilshire, he, you know, he's instrumental in blocking this visa information and this information about terrorists being in the United States. He's instrumental in blocking it from getting to the FBI. And he is later detailed to the FBI's counterterrorism section to be one of those guys who's supposed to facilitate information. So the guy who's behind blocking information sharing is then sent over to the FBI, and you know, it, like where he could like keep an eye on this even further. It's mind-boggling. But he eventually sees this cable, which is called the March Cable, that says Al-Hazmi and Al-Midar are in the United States. Traveled to the United States. This is a cable that came through to CIA in March of 2000. He reaccesses it in May of 2001. He rereads it. So in May of 2001, he rereads the thing that says, hey, terrorists in the U.S. And he doesn't do anything, even at that point. And later, what he does is he tasks an agent there to just kind of review some materials, go back through the cable traffic, try to shake something loose. And months later in August, the thing she shakes loose is the March cable that says, terrorists are in the United States. So it's like he sees this thing that says, here they are, and then all, you know, he tasks his agent to look through it, and all she finds is the very thing that he was originally looking at. And it's mind-boggling that Zelikow just is trying to, like, cheer this guy as someone who has been, like, who was extremely helpful before the fact.
Well, first of all, I'm pleased to hear that Zelikow and Governor Kaine are at least willing to talk with you, because over the last few years, I have been offered and accepted and scheduled interviews with co-chair Lee Hamilton and with Chief Counsel John Farmer, who published a book claiming it told everything about 9/11. And both of those gentlemen canceled their interviews, apparently after discovering that I might be critical of the work of the commission. So to me, it's just slightly encouraging to see that Kaine and Zelikow are at least willing to address you at this point. Now, I want to reference for our listeners. Go ahead.
If I could add just one more small detail to that. You know, when we talked to Tom Kaine, one thing he did was he was nice enough to read that footnote 44 that I mentioned, in which Tom Wilshire prevents the FBI from knowing about two hijackers in the U.S. And when he finishes reading it, he closes the book, he looks up, and he tells us, you know, it's outrageous, and he says, that's one of the most troubling aspects of our entire report, that particular thing. Consider that. One of the most troubling aspects of their entire report, in the words of the commission chairman, ends up in a footnote in the report.
Well, that's very interesting, both in terms of Kaine's reaction and, of course, the way the report was kind of written around him, and we know that there was dissent among the members of the commission, but that they were pressed to approve the report on a unanimous basis. And that, again, leads to the cementing of an official story that doesn't hold up to careful scrutiny.
I have to jump in here.
Go ahead.
Well, I think Kaine is better in terms of coming across as better, relatively better than the rest, but really that doesn't absolve him in any way. First of all, the commission, the so-called commission, and all these commissioners, I mean, this, the reason he's saying, oh, this is outrageous, because it's getting exposed, and they know it's being exposed, and it's very well supported and documented. What else is he going to say? He's going to say it didn't happen? So he's trying to save face. Number two, he did exactly the same thing with every single exposure or the holes that were poked with this report. Oh, well, it was because we wanted to put those things there, but we had to workaround classification. Oh, we wanted to do this, but we were prevented. Oh, we wanted to interview these witnesses, but we were prevented. But that was not the case, because during the commission's so-called investigation, you're looking at 46 law enforcement and intelligence officers were purposefully blocked from providing testimony. And every single one of those commissioners knew about it.
Well, the two FBI agents that were involved in this footnote incident, Doug Miller and Mark Rossini, told us that they weren't interviewed by the commission either.
Oh, sure, they were not interviewed. John Cole was not interviewed. Colleen Rowley, for God's sake, was not interviewed. She was a Time Magazine Woman of the Year, Whistleblower of the Year, and she was not interviewed. I mean, the only reason we got there was because the Jersey widows, you know, Kristen and Lori and Patty, they basically pushed us inside and said, you don't do this, and we are going to raise hell. But after a while, they got tired. They couldn't do it with 48 people. We provided them with names. I mean, the same thing happened with Tony Schaefer. You start looking at the list, and it's not a list with two or three or four or five names. You're looking at 48 current and former intelligence and law enforcement officers and, in some cases, analysts that were excluded from this so-called investigation. So we had that. And then they blame things on classification. Then they blame things on time. Then they blame things on budget. And now that this comes out, Keane says, oh, my God, it's outrageous, because there's what else is going to say? Is he going to say it's wrong? He can't. This is well documented. So that doesn't make him a nice person or even nicer person. I mean, they like to save face and say, well, yeah, on the side. They were doing that game. They were playing that game with the widows, okay? They would go to one commissioner, and he would say, you know what? I totally agree with you. It's those two people who are blocking and doing this. Then they would go and have meetings with the other two, and they were told, because I was with them when we were going through these. Then we were trying to give them the name. So they've been playing this game for too long, and I just really can't sit and keep quiet when Dean is being talked about as someone nice. Of course not. And of course they did have consensus. It was unanimous. They were selected for this job based on this. I mean, this is the commission that was first had Henry Kissinger as its chairman.
Right.
So this was all by design from the beginning. And now they're trying to save face with you, because you guys are saying, you know what? Here it is. This is what we have. And what else do you expect him to say? Either it's going to be no comments from people, or it's going to be, oh, my God, it's outrageous. I was a footnote there, too. I mean, there are so many footnotes there. And maybe it will take another 15 years for us to go through maybe 25, 30 footnotes out of 100. So that kind of points to something more macro, doesn't it?
Is that Tom Kane will kind of just say, well, you know, I don't know, Philip Zelikow was really in charge of all of that. I mean, today he actually, we asked him if he was at the interview of Rich Blee, the guy at the center of our story, who's only the head of the Bin Laden station at the time that Bin Laden, you know, surprise attacked the country. And he wasn't sure. He couldn't quite recall whether he'd gotten to that one or not, because he said he had to commute in from New Jersey, which we thought was pretty funny. I mean, in a sad kind of a way, but.
Well, what is your reaction, though, to Sabell's larger point, which is that he really has no choice at this point? He can either say no comment, he can say he stands by the original report, or he can say, oh, I'm distressed to learn this.
I mean, I guess it's true. Today we listed him all of the major areas of the story we're telling in the Who is Rich Blee thing, none of which made it into the report. And we asked him, you know, why? And again, he just kind of deferred to Philip Zelikow. He just kind of said, well, you know, Zelikow was kind of on top of that. You should talk to him and Chris Korn. And so we did. We emailed Zelikow, and Zelikow refuses to interview in an actual interview scenario. He'll only do email exchanges, which allow him to sort of miss the point each time in the email. But, you know, it is what it is.
I mean, we agree with the larger point that the commission was set up to fail. I mean, they didn't want a commission in the beginning. The fact that they had to, like, fight tooth and nail to even get one, and then, of course, it's set up with, you know, not enough money and not enough time. You know, you got someone has to, like, you know, the NSA says, sure, come read our stuff, and, like, one lowly commission staffer has to, like, drive across, across town to go, like, look through boxes and boxes of these NSA documents, and, like, no one else in the commission had any interest in them. And, you know, it was, I think the general consensus for anyone who's looked at this, even in remote details, that it was, yeah, it was pretty much set up to fail. And, but I will say it did leak, it did get out a few important points, and, you know, those little tidbits have been good things for us to kind of grasp onto and move on with. And
another thing in their favor, by the way, is that they did make the decision to go ahead and release the documents related to the report, which the joint inquiry still has not done. And because those documents came out, a researcher named Kevin Fenton, working with History Commons, who, you know, your audience may be familiar with Paul Thompson, but this sort of Kevin Fenton kind of has been his, you know, one of his greatest aides.
Yes, Kevin has been writing for Boiling Frogs Post, and he's going to have his CIA 9/11 series, I think, starting this coming Thursday. So he has already written 4 articles for us.
So Fenton's the one who found this commission document that allowed us to know at long last who this Rich B is that headed Bin Laden Station, and it turns out it was Rich Flea.
Yeah, I mean, this guy's name, you know, was hidden for so long. You know, he was written as just, you know, Rich. No one knew him except, you know, by anything except, you know, the name Rich, which you weren't even sure if it was his name or a code name, because so many of names in the reports are code names. And George Tenet, you know, his book says Rich B. And then just in some, you know, little document that gets declassified in 2009, Fenton finds one spot where someone did not redact the name, you know, Rich Blee, which was in, like, a footnote on some little document. And, like, it was supposed to have been redacted. It was redacted everywhere else, but someone, you know, either intentionally or unintentionally, you know, forgot to run a black marker over in one spot.
Now, Ray and John, let me do a quick recap here for the benefit of listeners who may not have heard our recent podcast with Paul Thompson. I want to direct people to your website at secrecykills.com, secrecykills.com. That is where you can see the 12 or 13-minute excerpt of your interview with former White House advisor Richard Clark. And it's also the site where your audio documentary will be released on the 11th of September this year. And I'd like you to recap, if you could, briefly, the responses that Richard Clark gave you, and in particular, the fact that he was kept out of the loop on the visas that were issued to Hamzi and Midhar, and that in particular, there were 2 critical points, including a principals meeting, I believe that was on September 3rd of 2011. Correct me if that's the wrong date.
Fourth.
It was what?
The 4th,
thank you. And in that meeting, it's very clear that Richard Clark was once again kept out of the security loop on this critical information.
Yeah, well, you know, this footnote 44 incident that we've mentioned a lot of times pretty much established that the FBI was deliberately prevented from knowing about Midhar entering the U.S. What we didn't know was whether perhaps CIA had chosen to do that, you know, on orders from the White House as part of some kind of an op, or it just wasn't clear what the White House knew. So we went and we talked to Richard Clark, and you know, he had written 5 pages that alluded to this in his 2008 book, Your Government Failed You. So we read that, and we said, well, let's just, you know, we'll shoot him an email, we'll see what happens. And he was actually eager to talk to us about it. And we thought we were going to have to kind of, you know, work him over a little bit to try to get him to that point. But really, he interrupted us about 2 questions in and said, look, guys, here's what I think happened. And that's when he kind of revealed that it wasn't just White House that wasn't receiving that info from these guys at CIA Alex Station and higher, but it was also Richard Clark and people at the White House level and the National Security Council. We're not receiving that at the very same time, and then for the following year and a half after, up to 9/11.
And what else did Clark offer, either on the interview or separately, that we haven't seen yet, that supports this notion, this contention that he has made, that there clearly was an effort to keep that information compartmentalized, and he wasn't given access to that compartment?
Well, Clark offers, if you watch what we've cut together is that he is privy to flood of daily threat information. You know, when he, or at least was, you know, when he was working at the counterterror center at the White House, you know, he'd flip on his computer in the morning, and there's just a just deluge of CIA reports that he gets, and it's, you know, it's a lot of tidbits, minutiae, but I mean, this is stuff that, you know, the raw data has gone to a reports officer at the CIA. They've written it up into, you know, sort of plain English, and it goes right to him. He's privy to a lot of stuff coming in all the time about a million different things. Now, what's critical to understand is that is the time frame that this all happened in. This is right after the millennium period, you know, and there was a big sort of terrorist threat at that time. You know, if you remember, they were worried about like attacks in Seattle, I believe, and other places. And at this time, they were also aware of a summit, a meeting of these Al-Qaeda figures in Malaysia, and this is something. This is not like a little thing. This was huge. This was like when we talked to our source at Alex Station. He's saying, sure, people might try to make the excuse that, hey, there's a lot of stuff going on. We're paying attention to a lot of things at once. He's like, this was the thing. This was what was going on at the time. This summit in Malaysia. I mean, they've been monitoring this Al-Qaeda communication center in Yemen for years. And they find out that, you know, people who stay there, particularly Khalid Al-Midar, are going to Malaysia. All these people are coming together. I mean, they have an intense focus on this. The CIA used the resources from 8 CIA stations around the globe. They requested help from, like, 6 foreign intelligence services. And, I mean, their spycraft was, like, top-notch at this time. They sent someone to break into Khalid Al-Midar's hotel room in Dubai, in the UAE, and that's where they got a copy of his passport. So they clearly know that this is important stuff. So, you know, and at the time, you know, Richard Clark is aware of this meeting. He's getting briefings about this meeting. Briefings about this meeting are going to the then National Security Advisor, Sandy Berger. They're going to the head of the FBI. Like, everyone's really focused on this. And then you have this, you know, Ahmad Rassam character who, you know, basically gets caught at the Canadian border trying to truck a bomb down to LAX to blow it up. So the threat level's huge. But somehow, you know, he's privy to all this information, all this real important stuff. But this one thing that, you know, terrorists have U.S. multiple entry visas, which means they probably have intent to use them, this one thing gets omitted from him. I mean, he gets daily phone calls from George Tenet, 7 in the morning, that are just, they're going over everything, the minutia, the little stuff. He doesn't get this. All his automatic updates on his computer, doesn't get this. I mean, it's the incompetence or the forgot sort of excuse goes out the window when there's a very specific failure that repeats over and over and over and over again. And it's at Clark's level. It's, you know, going to the FBI. I mean, it's, and when we, you know, when you listen to our final piece here, you'll see that it's, you know, the amount of times this information should have been passed, could have been passed, and wasn't, is just incredible.
And if I can just add one more thing, you know, I keep referring to that footnote 44 incident, but it really takes on, a sort of three-dimensional life when you listen to a guy named Mark Rossini, who was an FBI agent working in Alex Station at the time. And Rossini tells this story about how, you know, a couple days after this FBI agent Doug Miller tries to warn the FBI and he gets told to hold off by Tom Wilshire, he goes up to this desk officer who we're forced to call by her alias right now, Michelle. We're hoping to change that for the piece, but for right now, we'll call her Michelle. And he goes up to Michelle and he says, hey, what's the deal? We got to warn the FBI. These guys are, you know, coming to the U.S. Michelle puts a hand on her hip. And she says, this is not a matter for the FBI. He says, what are you talking about? This is, the FBI is the only guys who could, you can do anything about this now that, you know, the U.S. visa. And she says, when we want the FBI to know, we'll let them know. So when you add that into all the other information and then Richard Clark not getting that info as well, it clearly becomes way more than a coincidence, and the only question really is why.
Before we go any further, we asked this question. Actually, we asked Paul Thompson, and I want to hear your response to this question. With Clark, Richard Clark, why now? I mean, this is the 10th anniversary, and we went through all the commission and the all the shenanigans, and it's been now just the 10th anniversary is coming. Why now?
See, what we're finding as we've talked to these various people in government, even guys working one cubicle down from some of the people that we've been investigating, they don't
right. They'll
know little pieces of their own story, but they don't know the whole story. Frankly, they go on with their lives, and they haven't gone through it and then conducted their own interviews the way we have. So I think Richard Clark came to this slowly, kind of the same way everyone else did. It gets leaked out in a footnote to the commission report. Nobody reads that footnote. About a year and a half later, the Justice Department releases their Inspector General's report that starts to give a lot more detail on this. Now it starts to look like there's something fishy. The next year, the FBI cooperates en masse, giving interviews to Lawrence Wright for his Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Looming Tower. Now the picture starts to become really clear. And then finally, you know, the executive summary. The CIA is nice enough to release their executive summary to their OIG report, which is still classified and still being withheld from the public. But the summary reveals that 50 CIA agents knew about this. So I think over the years, Clark has, like, read this stuff and started to go, wait a minute, what was going on here?
I mean, you have to understand. I mean, he believes in the best intentions of the people he's working around at the time. So, like, as these facts kind of dribble out over the years, he himself had to start kind of stitching them together. And if when you say, why now, like, why is he talking now, it's not – I've seen a lot of sort of negative things since we released our piece that, you know, say he's trying to grab at another 15 minutes of fame. It's absolutely not that at all. We interviewed him in 2009.
Two quick questions so that we can eliminate that option. Does he have a new book that is coming out anytime soon?
Not that we're aware of. I mean, and he's not, you know, other reporters, when we put this out, a lot of other reporters tried to get in touch with him, and he wouldn't answer their phone calls. If he wanted, you know, to put his face out there, he could be talking to a lot bigger reporters than us. I mean, people from Washington Post, Daily Beast, they're calling him to get comment, and he's not answering. I mean, they're not, you know.
His current position, last time I checked with him, this was around 2007, and he has a pretty nice-sized consulting firm in Arlington, in Roslyn. Is he still there?
Yeah, that's where we did the interview.
Okay, and does he work with the current administration, with Obama administration, as an advisor or consultant?
I haven't seen that anywhere, but I would not know. Have you seen anything to that effect? Or?
No, but it would be good to know, because if you're a consultant, you know, and this is one of the things I'm finding out as I start covering cases, issues, I like to, for example, if it's an organization, I want to know who's funding this organization. If it's the person, I just found out on Bruce Fine, tomorrow the article is going to come out that nobody has put out there. He's a foreign lobbyist for 5 different countries. So nobody has ever put it out there, but that has been his income source, and he's been making millions of dollars. And that comes to become, you know, that comes to be important when we are start looking at a person, trying to find out who is this person, what are his intentions, are they good, are they bad? And I'm not saying his intentions are bad. I just want to get a grasp of Richard Clark, because he, in a way, talked about himself as a whistleblower when he came forward. Do you remember that during the commission?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
big whistleblowers conference in Congress, and this was when we had even some big congressional representatives present. And this was Colleen Rowley, Tony Schaefer, myself. And that was when, actually, I checked with him at his Roslyn office, and he just looked at us and he said, I will come if you pay me $5,000 for 30 minutes block. And I said, no, you said you're a whistleblower. This is about whistleblowers and the laws. And he said, I understand, but to come and talk for 15, 20 minutes in front of the Congress about the whistleblowing issues, I will charge $5,000. So I'm trying to get a little bit of a grasp of what he's doing right now. Who is Richard Clark today? Who are his clients? Is he working with the Obama administration? You know, it would be good to get a sense of who Richard Clark is, and just in case, because if this comes out and then somebody else comes out and says, let's say if Tenet is pissed, and if Tenet comes out and says, oh, by the way, here is the motivation and here is what Richard Clark is doing, it would be good to know what the guy has been doing. Where is he getting his money, you know? Who is he working with?
His firm is a cybersecurity firm.
Yes.
So I can't imagine that he doesn't have at least some government contract.
Mm-hmm.
And going from saying this stuff, I can't imagine is making too many friends for him in the government. So, I mean, I don't know. If someone was trying to, he was trying to say these things to, you know, promote himself.
I agree with you. It doesn't sound like a promotion, because you know what? He has his connections to the network. And with the anniversary coming, he can't be on every single channel like the commissioners usually do. They come and they kind of bask in the, you know, under the spotlight. But I don't. I agree with you. I don't think that's the intention. But it's just good to have a grasp of who is this guy today. You know, it's good to say, well, he's bothered by this, and his conscience is being kind of bothered, and now he's coming across some of these facts. After 9 years, he's putting them together, and he wants to talk, and yet he's not putting into some big books. Maybe not. Maybe yes. We don't know. You know, who is he working with? We don't know. What kind of beef he has currently with Tenet? We don't know. Maybe they are competing for some contract. You know, I don't know. I'm just bringing it up, saying I would like to know personally what Richard Clark has been doing. Who is he, this guy, and where his income is coming from? Because that helps me to determine, okay, who is this? Is this person? I don't mind if he has government contracts, but it's good to know. Because if he has, and for those contracts he needs to have clearance, they usually go out of their ways either not to talk about or anything, or if they talk about something that may be bothersome for the intelligence community, they do it for a reason. And it's good to know.
To me, it's distracting to sort of focus in on, like, Clark's intentions. I've seen a number of, I mean, I'm not saying it's a bad thing to look at. I've seen a number of pieces that where people put a ton of time, apparently, into just researching Clark's background and possible connections. And I think that sort of misses the point. See, most of what Clark has put out there in this interview with us is not, like, information that he claims is that only he has. I mean, most of this, he's just simply saying, like, this is what's sort of out there in these various reports, and if you piece it all together, this is the picture that you get. And his little new piece of that picture is that he never received anything in any of the updates from Tenet that ever mentioned Midhar or Hazmi. So I think really it's more about looking at the details of what he's pointing towards. You know, I mean, if it comes out tomorrow that he skins puppies and wears their skin as coat, it doesn't really make any difference as to whether or not, you know, the CIA had this repeated pattern of not telling various government agencies about these two hijackers, specifically their travel to the United States.
In 2004, 2005, when the commissioner's report, you know, came out, I mean, that was when some really, the truly courageous government insiders who had either retired, or some of them were still, you know, in their positions, they came out, and it was a gutsy move because the media, they were saying what a great piece of work that was, that report, and all these people, the big names, they were applauding the commissioners, okay? And when we stood there, Abby said, you know what, this is absolutely incomplete. A lot of witnesses were censured, and the information that even some of the stuff they have there is either half-baked or it's not true. And the people came forward, and even though they were countered by the media, and they said, this is not good. And this was 2004, 2005. I really, really would have loved to have Clark with us there saying that, because he had the moral authority. He had the position. He had the title. He had the name. It would have been great to have Richard Clark to come out and say, you know, this is not the real report. But
well,
he didn't. I mean, he was applauding the commissioners.
And, Sabelle, with a $5,000 request for payment, that kind of testimony should be flagged as paid commentary. I am not aware of anyone who has been asked to testify before Congress who, in turn, asked an interest group to pay him for his time to do so.
Well, he said he is registered with the Speaker's Bureau, and whenever he gives speeches and talks and testifies, basically it goes with a block of hours. So whether it's 30 minutes or 1 hour, it's a $5,000 flat fee. That's what he and his secretary told us.
He said, and Ray and John, he didn't charge you for your interview, right?
Nope.
Okay, no, I just didn't want to get bogged down. Let's continue.
Okay,
it out there, and we can just go ahead.
Thanks, Sabelle. Next,
we had to rub his leg
for
a while.
We were supposed to give him a massage, but that was it. Yeah.
Well, and didn't you have to bring in a fire extinguisher in case his hair got on fire?
that was George Tenet who said that.
Oh, okay. I thought Richard Clark's hair was on fire, too. I guess I mixed that up. Well, since we've mentioned Tenet, I wanted to ask you something that we discussed briefly with Paul Thompson. and that was that Richard Clark and George Tenet were both holdovers from the Clinton administration. And George Tenet certainly ingratiated himself with Bush, probably Cheney, and was a very key player in all of these events and got the Medal of Freedom from W after he retired from CIA. But Richard Clark didn't fare so well in the Bush White House and was clearly frustrated from his previous statements, and it's echoed in the interview that you conducted. Do you have any theories on why Clark was the outsider, and did that have any influence on his exclusion from the critical information that's noted in footnote 44?
That's a possibility. I mean, I think if you just, you know, go to the record, I mean, Clark was there to work counter-terror, and he was now working with, he went from one administration that gave a shit to one that didn't. I mean, you know, he's going in there and, like, they're telling him they don't want to hear another thing about this. I mean, and we all know that, you know, Bush and Cheney walked through the doors wanting to invade Iraq. And, you know, they were constantly focused on it despite the fact that it wasn't a threat. So, I mean, their head was, you know, just, you could see why Clark would be frustrated with them. And, of course, you know, when he obviously wasn't willing to play ball with them, when they're floating ideas like, let's have a plane fly real low over Iraq so they shoot it down so we can invade, you know, when they're floating ideas like that, I mean, he's obviously like, what the hell are you guys doing, you know?
And actually, one thing in that regard is that there were two updates that that George Tenet gave to George W. Bush in August of 2001. And when the commission, we got to remember that when he was there in a live hearing before the commission, he was asked, did you update, you know, the president in August? And he said, no. He said, not even by phone? No. And right after he left and could no longer be asked follow-up questions, his PR guy, Bill Harlow, the same one that we dealt with, went ahead and sent a message on into the commission saying, you know, hey, by the way, that was a mistake. He actually updated him twice, once on August 17th and then once on August 31st. So, again, they couldn't ask, well, what did you talk about at that, you know, particular point in time. And the August 31st one is interesting because at that point, you know, Tenet knows about Moussaoui. And he also should, if things were functioning right at CIA, have been told by Rich Blee and Kofor Black that the FBI was currently searching for these two terrorists, Midhar and Hazmi, in the country. So what type of conversations are they having on August 31st? We don't know. And because of Tenet's lie to the commission, was never able to ask.
So, gentlemen, next I want to turn to the remarkable but not very forthcoming statement that was issued in response to your release of the Richard Clark video interview. And at the same website, secrecykills.com, you have posted this statement that was supplied by Harlow, who you just referred to, and is purportedly a joint statement from George Tenet, Kofor Black, who moved on from the CIA to work for Blackwater, now called Z, and Richard Blee, the mystery man who you basically flushed out of the Bushes. I'm sorry I used that term, Bush. At any rate, their denial, I think, is as instructive as some of the allegations made by Richard Clark. So first, Ray, would you like to talk about the very careful language that is used by the CIA trio in trashing Richard Clark?
Sure. If your audience actually wants to go to secrecykills.com, if they're at a computer right now, they can read along. But the main gist is that they do two things. One, they basically call Clark, you know, reckless and profoundly wrong in his comments, and they, you know, they use words like speculation and try to sort of paint him as one thing. They try to besmirch his character. And then the other thing is they basically say they've talked to the 9/11 commission, and they, you know, they stand by that testimony and what the commission found. In the original statement that they gave to us, they gave a lot of sort of inaccurate and sort of half-truths that that we could point to, but I think their language is sort of more interesting even than their half-truths. You know, for instance, what they deny and what they don't deny is really interesting. You know, for instance, they don't say that the director and other senior CIA officials were unaware of the information about these two terrorists inside the U.S. What they say is that the record shows that the director and other senior CIA officials were not aware of it. They point out that this was all looked at exhaustively by the commission, the joint inquiry, the CIA inspector general. But, of course, the CIA inspector general's report has never been released to the public, and it reportedly called for accountability boards to look at a number of these folks, which would have included probably Kofor Black, Rich Flea, probably even Tenet. We actually have a source that is going to be providing us with hopefully some information who's seen the unclassified or who's seen the classified version of that CIA report. What else do they say here? They say the commission concludes that no one informed higher levels of management in either the FBI or CIA about the case. Well, there's a dot, dot, dot at the beginning of that sentence, and what that dot, dot, dot replaced was it seems likely. So those words, it seems likely, are kind of important there. They're much less definitive. And
in reference later.
It's also in reference to beginning in August of 2001 when the FBI begins searching for those guys in the country. At that point, the 9/11 Commission concludes that they weren't told. But what about in March of 2000 or January of 2000 when they first arrived in the country and the whole footnote incident happens and the Richard Clark stuff, you know? We could go on, but it's all sort of like that.
Well, next, gentlemen, I'd like to ask you, you supplied us with an outline of some of the key points in your new audio documentary, and I'd like you to just briefly, if you could, alternate and take us through each of these points to give our listeners a sense of what you are going to cover so that they will be induced to come and listen to your entire documentary.
All right. Well, the first thing was this footnote incident. There was a young female SOO named, we've got to call her Michelle for right now, but we're working on giving the real name. Hopefully on September 11th, that'll come out in our piece. She was the one who was running this entire op to follow these terrorists in Malaysia and this whole sort of detailed operation that my colleague John Duffy kind of described earlier. And so Doug Miller attempted to draft this cable, rightly so, in January of 2000. Go ahead and let his boss at FBI headquarters and the New York field office, which handles sort of bin Laden matters, which included the famous John O'Neill, who died in the attacks, when he tried to warn them, he received this please hold off for now per Tom Wilshire order. And that order was placed on that by this person, Michelle, this desk officer, resulting in the argument that Mark Rossini later had with her over, this is not a matter for the FBI, okay? Now, what's so interesting about her saying that is 2 days before having the argument with Mark Rossini, she actually sent a cable throughout CIA misleading her own agency that this information about the visa was passed to FBI. She obviously knew that was not the case if 2 days later she's getting in a heated argument with an FBI person about the fact that it can't be passed. Now, at the same time, over at FBI headquarters, there's this other agent who we've been told has a real reputation for being slippery. And again, we can't tell you his name at this time, but we're working on that. But this guy is over there, and what he does is he goes ahead and he updates two bosses at the bin Laden unit of FBI with everything about this Kuala Lumpur operation and what Midhar and Hazmi were doing, every detail except for this visa information regarding them coming to the U.S. And then he sends an email back to these same people, like Wilshire, like this desk officer, Michelle, at Alex Station, letting them know exactly what he's told FBI in case they, quote-unquote, complain later that they weren't told. So, that's sort of point number one in what becomes a... Basically, what seems to be there's something called a close hold that seems to have been placed on any information related to Midhar Hazmi coming to the U.S., and that just simply could not pass from CIA to FBI at that time, and we don't know why. Duffy?
I guess the second thing we seem to hit on is about Rich Blee, then the director of Alex Station. As far as the surveillance of Midhar and Hazmi as they leave the Malaysia summit, now the official story says that when they leave Malaysia and they fly to Bangkok, and that doggummit, the CIA people in Bangkok lost these men in the busy streets. Now, like, I don't know if it's believable whether or not the CIA can't follow people in crowded areas. If so, we shouldn't let that information out, because now everyone knows how to slip a CIA guy, just go somewhere crowded. But basically, later, Lee gives this update, you know, a couple of days later, to his sort of boss, their Kofor Black Tenet, and he tells them surveillance is ongoing. Now, what does he mean by that? Like, if the official story says they lost him in Bangkok, but then, you know, a week later he claims surveillance is ongoing, does that mean that the CIA is actually following them to the U.S., or is Blee just mistaken and doesn't know what he's talking about? That, you know, that seems really strange. But to say they lost him in Malaysia is strange for another reason, in Bangkok, is because these guys, when they were in Malaysia, they used a public payphone, used a public internet cafe, and they're not, you know, they're not what the media makes them out to be. These guys are pretty easy to follow. These Mihdhar and Hazmi, they're not great crack espionage units. They're kind of bunglers. You know, they're using these public services and stuff, and so all these people who are watching them and following them, they just go and get the phone records from the phone they're using. They go to the internet cafe and grab the hard drives from the computers they've used, and. But, and, you know, this information that they just took there should clearly lead them to the hotel they're staying at in Bangkok. So you're claiming, okay, we lost them in the busy streets. Let's go to that information that you grabbed and see, hey, they're going to the Washington Hotel. Let's just go there, look them up there. Or quickly, you know, just, you know, put something through to make sure, you know, if they leave the country, we'll find out. You know, it shouldn't have been that hard to keep tabs on these guys. You know, with the information they had available. And
the third point is, even if we take them at their word there that they then lost Mihdhar and Hazmi in Bangkok, they get another chance. In mid-March of 2000, they get a cable. March 5th, a cable comes in from Bangkok Station. Hey, we just heard from Thai authorities. Those guys actually flew out in mid-January, and they arrived in Los Angeles, Mihdhar and Hazmi, guys who attended this top-level al-Qaeda summit. They're in the United States. And the following day, we don't know what station, but another station also sends a reply on March 6th that goes also into Rich Blee's Alex station, and it goes into Kofor Black's CTC. And what that one says is they read with interest this cable, especially the fact that Mihdhar and Hazmi had arrived in the U.S. Well, this is one of the things where one of the investigations actually bothered to ask George Tenet about this. They asked, the joint inquiry asked in an open hearing, what was the deal with that? The March cable said, these guys had come to the U.S. How did you not take action on that? Why did you not tell the FBI at that point? And Tenet's response was, nobody read that in the March time frame. Well, we happen to have a source inside Alex Station. We've got a couple of them, but one of them is Mark Rossini. We asked Rossini, hey, did you read that in March? Yeah, I read it. I mean, you know, it came in over, like, the Hercules cable system. It was right there for everybody to see. I mean, I was like, well, if Blee or Black or Tenet would have read it, and he said, you know what, I'm not sitting in their offices while they're reading stuff, but the way that system is set up and the way things work there, I'm telling you, there's no way that they didn't read that cable at the time.
Now, so, this sounds like the denial that Condoleezza Rice used about the August 6th presidential daily briefing, where she said, well, we never thought they would attack with airplanes, and she used that curious phrase about maybe somewhere in the bowels of the agency. Now, it doesn't appear that Tenet, in his denial about the March 5th cable being read at the time, he didn't go into the bowels explanation. But his explanation now, with your, contradiction from an inside source at Alex Station, it rings like the bowels of the agency comment from Rice.
Moving on to the fourth little point here, this one is kind of murky. It's not going to be easy to explain here, so I'm just going to give some real broad strokes. After the coal bombing in Yemen, the FBI starts investigating, you know, that attack. And one of the lead agents on the case, a man named Ali Soufan, who's like John O'Neill's right-hand man, he's really getting into the nitty-gritty of this stuff, and he's doing a great job. And he sees money moving, away from Yemen kind of at the time of the attack. He sees that there's connectivity with this man named Khalid bin Atesh. And starting to put it all together, and he realizes that something was, you know, money was moving towards Malaysia in early 2000, and Atesh was going there, and like, what, you know, so he's wondering, okay, well, what was going on down there in Malaysia in early 2000? And, you know, he ends up requesting information from the CIA several times, you know, and they just kind of ignore him or tell him he don't have anything. But, you know, as this coal investigation comes together, what ends up happening is something very strange, where people from the CIA, from the Bin Laden unit, kind of set up this meeting with the coal investigators. And it's supposed to be an information-sharing meeting. Now, they kind of go in, there's a little pleasantry, and then the FBI just kind of opens up and says, this is what we got, this is what we're working with, this is what we're trying to put together. And then what the people from the CIA do is they take out this manila envelope, and it's got a couple of photographs in it. And these photographs are from the Malaysia summit. These are photographs of Nawaf al-Hazmi, Khalid al-Midar. They show them to the coal investigators and say, do you know who these men are? The coal investigators are like, no, who are they? They say, oh, well, we just wanted to know if you knew who they were. And basically, long story short, what's happening there is these people from Alex Station are trying to find out how far along the coal investigators are. How close are they to al-Midar and al-Hazmi? How close are they to realizing, you know, the sum total of this? And they basically went on a little information fishing trip, and it turned into a huge screaming match. You know, these FBI agents, like, demanding, like, who the hell are these guys? Where did you get these photos? How many photos are there? And, you know, it's hilarious that this is supposed to be an information-sharing meeting. Now, later, one of the people there, this woman named Gina Corsi, will say that, you know, she didn't know, she thought she was not allowed to share these photos. She thought they couldn't be passed. And but she had actually been given specific instruction that, you know, she could. And so, that's our fourth point, that basically, as the coal investigators are getting close, yeah, it kind of gets in there and says, okay, how close are they?
And, Ali, just one quick point here. Ali Soufan, the former FBI agent, is trying to publish a book, and he is in a continuing struggle with the CIA, which wants to do incredible redaction in his book. And he's gone public, Soufan, saying that he believes they are simply trying to avoid embarrassment. So I think it's interesting that the interagency squabble continues to this day.
It does, and we've spoken to Soufan. We've also spoken to Lawrence Wright, who told his story in detail in The Looming Tower. And Lawrence Wright said that he's always felt that this is the point in the story when it goes from being simple, just withholding of information that the FBI should have, to obstruction of justice in the FBI's criminal investigation of the murder of 17 U.S. sailors at the Cole.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, then we get to sort of point number five, which is that guy Tom Wilshire, the one who ordered Doug Miller not to send that cable, basically the guy who kept the deputy chief of Alex Station, Richard Blees, number two, you know, he actually ends up in what position in the in May of 2001? Of all positions, you would not want the guy who withheld information from the FBI to get. He becomes the intelligence representative to the head of the FBI's terrorism section. All right, he goes to work for this guy, Mike Rollins, that runs the terrorism section of FBI, which is pretty much the highest you can get in FBI at counterterror. It's one of them anyway. And mm-hmm. and so Wilshire is the guy that's facilitating, helping with intel there. This is at a critical time because the coal investigators at that point are really getting to some, you know, some important things, and Wilshire is right there in the mix now, like helping, quote unquote, these coal investigators. And that's when we get to the sort of the thing Duffy mentioned earlier, where Wilshire, right when he arrives at his new position at FBI, decides to be helpful. So he starts going through all of this cable traffic related to the Malaysia summit from way back in January of 2000. That's when he finds that cable. That March 5th cable, the one George Tenet testified nobody read in that time frame, well, fine. If nobody read it in that time frame, Wilshire accesses it then in May, okay? And so we know this because it's in the Justice Department Inspector General's report that he accessed that in May. So he reads this, that Midhar and Hazmi went to the U.S. And what does he do about it? Almost nothing. He assigns an FBI detailee over at Alex Station to look at it in her spare time, and she starts doing that. And then he begins a series of bizarre emails that we still don't really understand to this day, but basically he's emailing some of these same people, like this Michelle person that we mentioned, and Probably Rich Blee gets at least one of these emails, may have been involved in all of them. But he's emailing these people back at CIA, and he's essentially speculating that he's pretty sure that this guy Attash, that was like the big coal mastermind, is going to be at the center of the next attack, and that anybody connected to that guy is going to really be of interest. And he specifically mentions Khalid al-Midhar, the guy that he read had come to the U.S., and he says that guy who's connected to the coal mastermind probably going to be a bit of big interest. And he asks permission, can I please share this with FBI? Can I? And we don't know the response that he got. We only know the emails he sent, but you got to assume the response he got was, no, you still can't share this, because he never shared it. And that's when, at the end of that summer, Maggie Gillespie happens to find that same cable, that same March cable that they're in the U.S., and she starts the FBI hunt for these guys. And it turns out there was too little time before 9/11 to actually find them. And apparently Wilshire, when he gets told that she's found this cable, says nothing. He just kind of goes, oh, man, well, I guess we got to start a hunt for him. The same cable that he read back in May of 2001. And then the bigger question goes on to, and this is sort of the last big point, is the Tenet Black Blee thing with their hair on. You mentioned the hair on fire.
Right.
Right? And so what we always wondered was, their hair is on fire. They're going to people like Richard Clark. They're going to Condoleezza Rice. They're going to Bush, supposedly. This is the story we hear from the commission, and they're shaking them by the lapels. They're trying to get them to understand, but alas, they just never quite get it. That's the picture the CIA paints. And maybe it's partially correct. I mean, it's sure true that the Bush administration did very little about terrorism in the 9 months that they were in office there before 9/11. But did they tell this really pertinent piece? And that was, you know, the piece that Midhar and Hazmi had arrived in the country at that point, after August 22nd, when this FBI detailee has found this information and started the FBI on this search, you would think that there would be an update to George Tenet, to Kofor Black, at least to Rich Blee, about all of that, right? And they claim, supposedly, that they didn't receive that update and therefore never passed it on to the White House. Strains credulity, which was the chapter of, this is what Richard Clark called the chapter of his book on this subject, straining credulity.
So what kind of reaction have you been getting from the media with all this expose? Because, I mean, I put myself in their shoes, and I would be really embarrassed. And here you guys have been putting these pieces together, collecting all these facts and doing investigative journalism. And with these mainstream media people with all their resources, nobody has been doing any of this work.
Of course not.
Yeah, so what kind of reaction? I mean, do you get, silence, or do you get them actually send you inquiries, you know, from... Because sometimes they do. I mean, they just send an email on the side. I get it from a couple of guys in New York Times. By the way, this and this, how did you get that? I think you talked with this guy. They try to fish. You know, they go on a fishing expedition. What kind of reactions have you been getting?
Yeah, Sabelle, I mean, we've got a couple of funny stories related to that. When we finally decided to leak the Richard Clark interview, I mean, I think the headlines that it's made since then show that it was, you know, like, that there was going to be media, you know, interest in this, that this was newsworthy, let's say. But we sent it out before we found Jason Leopold at Truthout, and before we found Phil Shannon at the Daily Beast, literally sent it out to the Washington Post and so on and so forth as a press release, and got no response. And so we started panicking. We reached out to Leopold and to Shannon, and Leopold wrote a great piece on it. He's a really good reporter there at Truthout. But Shannon, even up to the night before he was supposed to run that story, you know, the Daily Beast is owned by Newsweek or vice versa, but essentially they're the same outfit.
Right.
And he was telling me that his editors over there didn't want to run it because they couldn't get Richard Clark to call them back and confirm he still stood by it. I said, well, there obviously wasn't any tricky editing. We let these long takes go by where Clark explains this. Isn't the story that Clark ever felt this way, you know? And so what we had to do was forward an email chain. This was an idea we came up with at like 11 p.m. the night before. We forward this email chain with Clark that established that he had read the CIA's joint statement to us. And at that point, finally runs with it. When they finally run the story, by the way, the initial story never mentioned us by name nor linked to any place where they could see our full video. Essentially, Shannon just kept referring to us as the producers of this sort of mystery documentary that he never bothered to make.
I saw that piece, right.
Well, and you're Jason Lee, gentlemen, I just want to point out Jason Leopold is a major contributor to my radio program, my podcast, and he has broken incredible big stories and gets the stories stolen by big outlets like The Post, like CNN, never with any credit for his detailed legwork.
He's a solid go-getter. He's excellent. I agree.
If I could tell a real short story, too, right after that Daily Beast story broke and was kind of getting a lot of attention, we got a call from a guy at the Washington Post saying that he'd heard we were the source behind that.
Uh-huh.
And he asked if we could get a transcript of the Clark piece. Now, at that point, we were releasing the Clark video later that night, so it hadn't come out yet. So we told him we didn't have – I basically emailed back. I said, we don't have a transcript of the Clark piece. I can send you the link to the 12-minute Clark piece as a private YouTube video. This is the same link that Phil Shannon received that he based his story on, right?
Right.
So we get an email back, sort of flippant little email that like, oh, I see this isn't going live until tonight, so we can't link to it, so we're just going to credit the Daily Beast. And I called him up, and I said, what do we need to do for you to not credit the Daily Beast, for you to credit and link to our story, because we want people to see Clark's words in his own, you know, him saying it, how he said it. And he was like, well, what is this video? And he hadn't even watched the video. And we were like, that's the piece that Shannon based this whole thing on. And he actually says, well, I've already written the story. What did you write the story on? You haven't seen the piece. he wrote it based on the Daily Beast story, and he wanted to get it out there. And finally, we convinced him to watch the piece. And he actually said, well, I guess I could just watch it and transcribe it myself. Yeah, isn't that what you're supposed to do?
Did he run the story?
He ran the story, and he included links, and he mentioned us. So that
what
was,
page?
That was, yeah.
And where did it show up in the paper, gentlemen?
Well, it never made it to the paper. It made it to the website of the Washington Post.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Very interesting.
Well, I just want to tell you guys, you have done amazing work, and it just puts all these investigative, so-called investigative journalists with the mainstream media and the pseudo-big alternatives. Really, shame. And I just want to congratulate you. And I'm glad that we have people like you.
And just to recap, secrecykills.com is the website where you can see the interview with Richard Clark and where the audio documentary will be released on September 11th. And that will be released in conjunction with the report that you heard referenced from Jason Leopold, and that will appear at truthout.org. Ray,
I have one last question, Peter. I'm sorry, because this is important, and I should have asked this question. No, I should have asked even Paul Thompson. What would you do? I mean, let's say 5 years down the road or on the 20th anniversary, if more pieces like this come out, would you still have the drive to pursue it, or would you say, my God, you know, all the things we have been exposing, all the things that have been exposed, and it's just not possible to even get excited anymore because we have found so much. You know, we have. And yet, you know, the majority of the country, they're like, there's a closed chapter. Yeah, we had the terrorists, and 9/11 happened. We had the Great Commission. We had congressional investigations. It's closed. It's like JFK assassination is gone. Or do you think you're going to be still driven and say, you know what, we're just going to keep at it? No, sincerely.
So, when we were working on Press for Truth and wrapping that up, we pretty much told ourselves no more 9/11 stuff. So, I mean, I don't know. If I say no now, I don't know if it'll stick in a couple of years. But, you know, then, because then, you know, once we chomped down to this little piece of bait, we just couldn't help it. And really, you know, at the end of the day, you know, for me, sometimes the drive is just a fucking mystery. Sorry, I shouldn't swear. It's just a mystery. You know, it's a mystery that, in a way, just kind of intrigues me. And this might sound awful, but, you know, people always say, well, what do you, you know, do you want a new investigation? Or you want, you know, what do you want done about this? And I'm like, I have no answer to that. Like, quite frankly, it's just like, I just kind of want to know myself. It was, you know, it was weird that this was a defining event in my life because I'm, you know, I was 20 years old and I lived in Chicago. I wasn't affected by this at all. I didn't lose any family members. There's nothing really attaching me to it other than the obsessive fact that, like, it's so fascinating. The story is full of so many twists and turns. false leads and false trails. I mean, it somehow just hooked my brain, you know, in a way like when you hear a riddle and you can't figure it out, that you just can't stop thinking about it until you get something, you know. And like, I mean, so I don't know. I think it comes in fits and spurts. You know, we'll probably go a little time, kind of forget about it, and then, you know, someone will be on their deathbed, drop some bombshell confession, and we'll be right back at it.
Well, gentlemen, let me add my thanks for your work, and thanks for joining us today on The Boiling Frogs. We've been talking with Ray Novoselsky and John Duffy.
Thank you for what you do.
Give me absolute control over every living soul, and I'm sadly leaving. That's an order. Take the only tree that's left, stuff it up the hole in your culture. Give me a bank of burning wall, give me a star in a sail hall. I've seen the future, brother. It is murder.
Leo Cohen and the future. The future. Well, that depends on us. Thank you for joining us. We'll be back soon with more Boiling Frogs interviews.